Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're about 5 weeks away from the 2022 primary election. It's scheduled for June 7th, and the general election is in November. At stake are important local, statewide, and congressional seats, including races like Sacramento County Sheriff and California Attorney General. Now, having just come off the recall election of Governor Gavin Newsom in September, it's understandable that voters' attention may not yet be focused on casting ballots. But our news team here at Cap Radio is planning on giving you everything you need to vote with confidence. To kick off our 5 weeks of political coverage leading up to the primary, we've invited Cap Radio's managing editor of news, Nick Miller, and news editor Chris Hooks for a look at the local and statewide races we'll be following closely. Good morning, Nick and Chris.
Hey, Vicky.
Hey, Vicky, how's it going?
All right, Nick. A lot of conversations have been taking place for kind of like this roadmap of how we're going to cover the primaries. What kind of conversations were taking place in the newsroom? Peel back the layer a little bit.
You know, it's kind of funny, Vicky, because I think the first conversation was just recognizing, and I did a little math when we first started our election journey earlier this year, that this will be our third election in Sacramento and in California in 19 months. So the third election in just over a year and a half. So we're just sort of processing this normalcy that intense, combative, divisive elections are part of our lives now. And I think it's important to just sort of name that because it takes a lot of energy for all of us, not just here in the newsroom, of course, but just everyone who's thinking about voting, thinking about, you know, how they're going to cast their ballot, absorbing all these ads that inundate them on social media, on TV. That's the first step is like, that's the experience of our communities right now. And we need to recognize and name that because it affects, you know, how we're going to approach getting information out to people. And the second goal really, Vicky, is just local. For, you know, there are contests in Sacramento City Council, the Board of Supervisors, District Attorney, Sheriff. These are races that are going to transform our community. These races they're going to be, I think the term people use are hotly contested races, right? There's a lot of new, younger voices, for instance, in city council. We have, four open seats for Sacramento City Council out of the 8 seats, and that's normal every 2 years. But 3 of them are going to be, you know, really tightly contested, and they may not even be decided in June. And that's not been normal, at least in my experience covering City Hall the last couple decades, is sometimes you just see people sort of waltz into their council seat. That's not going to be the case this year.
Yeah, I mean, what you're really talking to, I think what we all collectively experience is kind of fatigue when it comes to the election cycle, but cutting through that really, because these are races that affect our everyday lives. What is the overarching mission that you guys decided on?
Yeah, that's a really good point. We're tired, there's fatigue, but this election really matters. And our goal is to break through that exhaustion and give people sort of the essential information that they care about. They can figure out where the candidates weigh in and stand on that and help cast their vote on June 7th or earlier. We know ballots are actually going to be going out. You'll start to see them in your mailboxes in about a week, week and a half. So potentially you can vote in a week, week and a half if you wanted to. And about 20% of Sacramentans actually vote in those first 2 weeks when they get their ballot in their mailboxes. The big thing is, you know, how to navigate those key issues, housing affordability, homelessness, you know, this new moment in the pandemic. Jobs in the economy are always big. So those are sort of the things that I think we're going to want to hold the candidates to account on and serve them in our voter guide.
All right, Chris, that brings me to you. You work so closely with our reporting staff. What are the local races that you're devoting reporting resources to?
Yeah, I mean, just like you and Nick have both said now, just local for everything, essentially. So anything local we'll likely be covering. I mean, we have the Board of Supervisors District 5 race, which will also be hotly contested. The 3 city council districts, Districts 1, 3, 5. District 7, Councilmember Jennings is running unopposed, so obviously we won't be covering that one. We'll also be obviously covering the district attorney race, Senate District 8, which is City Councilwoman Angela Gashby running against former State Commissioner Dave Jones. We'll be covering Assembly District 10, 7, 6, obviously the Congress House where Sheriff Scott Jones is running in, Attorney General, and covering as much as the governor race as we, I guess, need to in this case. We know that obviously we just ran into that recall last year, so there's going to be some things to cover for that as well. So,
I mean, you're laying out a lot of races. What conversations are you and reporters having, and making sure that you know you're staying up to date with every race? I think you laid out like close to a dozen.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a long road to November, and we just have to keep that in mind. Obviously, you know. Primaries are next month. You said 5 weeks, I believe you said, which is crazy to think about, but it's true. So it's a long road from now to November, and keeping that front of mind, knowing, you know, voters are going to have questions for a very long time about who's running, why they're running, what their platforms are, and more answers specific to whatever may be going on in their own neighborhoods. So trying to make sure that we're finding ways to answer as many questions as we can from now until November and from now until June in some cases. And that's really the conversations we're having, is making sure we do that.
And Chris, hold on, Chris, you said long road, and I just wanted you to share how long a road it's been for you, because I think you've been having coffee with these candidates since maybe last year, but definitely January, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly January, I've had coffee with the city council candidates for sure. I mean, you have candidates who have been in these races since for a year and a half at this point. Like, there have been some candidates who have just really been on the ground already, and it really has been a long road. It's Nick said 19 months, and it feels a lot shorter than that, and it feels like there's been more elections in that time than there actually has been. So
Not to mention, you know, when they started campaigning last year, there's, you know, this whole thing called redistricting that happened, and things just got shuffled around. And that brings me to a new congressional district. We have one in our area, District 3. Talk to us about it. It's a huge area.
Yeah. Can I take this one, Chris? District 3 is this sprawling new district. And I want to give people the opportunity to visualize it, because when I first saw it on the map, I was like, say what? What is this? So it starts like east of Chico, and it almost goes all the way north to Susanville. So, you know, really far north, goes through the foothills, the Sierra Nevada. It includes the Sacramento foothills. So if you're in Roseville, Rockland, Lincoln, if you're in the Tahoe Basin, this is your district. But then it goes all the way south down to like Death Valley, Vicky. I mean, this is, you know, it's about 38% Republican registration.
I'm visualizing the counties.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of want to go on a road trip this year, Chris and Vicky. Maybe we can do a little road trip through the district. But yeah, it's a crazy new district.
Let's do it.
I don't want to say crazy. It's an interesting, unique new district that includes a huge swath of California. And so Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones is running for Congress again in this district. One of his GOP challengers is Rockland Assemblyman Kevin Kiley. And Vicky, you know him because he ran in the recall election against Governor Newsom last year. So they're battling for, to get to that November ballot in this new extraordinary district.
Yeah, I'm just visualizing the drive from Susanville to Death Valley. So I think that's a good 6 hours. Probably includes a lot of Highway 395. What about Attorney General? I mean, we've been having conversations about the AG's race on Inside. I mean, it's probably, when we're using the word hotly contested, I mean, it's probably one of the bigger races that we're following statewide.
It is. So there's three candidates in this race. It's one of those lucky statewide races where we have three people vying for it. You know, Attorney General Rob Bonta, he was appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom. He's the Democrat. There's Nathan Hochman. He's the Republican. He's a defense attorney for wealthy clients. He comes in when, you know, clients are in trouble, usually with taxes or the IRS. But he's also had stints as a U.S. Attorney of California. And then you have Anne-Marie Schubert. And that's a familiar name for Sacramentans, because Anne-Marie Schubert is our district attorney in Sacramento County. But she is no longer going to be our DA. She's going to leave that office, and she's running for attorney general as a no party preference candidate. And so this is a fascinating race. It's really interesting to see if Anne-Marie Schubert can break through as an NPP and get to the final two in November, whereas, you know, typically it's one Republican versus one Democrat.
Yeah, and she was a longtime Republican who changed her voter registration a couple years back. All right, Chris, let's go now to State Senate District 8. That is a council member, Angelique Ashby, current council member in Sacramento, as well as Dave Jones, the former insurance commissioner.
Yeah, so you set it up right. There's this one is interesting because it sets up a lot of different things. Obviously, it's a state senate race that's in our area, so it's very specific to Sacramentans. But it's also interesting because you have Angelique Ashby, a longtime city councilwoman, who is stepping into a statewide race and leaving behind her own district in Natomas. Obviously, she can't run for both. You know, you already have people vying for her old seat now as she's stepping away to run for this as well. So it's going to be interesting because it has a lot of different layers of who's affected and how. So this is also going to be a very interesting race to watch.
And I'm curious, Chris, because so you have Ashby ran for mayor, did not succeed, yep. Lost to Daryl Steinberg. Is getting the endorsement of current state senator Richard Pan, whose seat she is vying to replace, is a Democrat, but has sort of been sort of a centrist Democrat, has a lot of support from law enforcement, business. And then you have Dave Jones. I mean, Dave Jones was a council member in the 90s, has served on the assembly before, was a statewide office, is considered a little more progressive, has support from the Democratic Party. And let me tell you, his flyers that are showing up on in my mailbox, Instagram, they let you know this is going to be a brutal race. There's a billboard by my house, Vicky. It says not Dave Jones. And it shows Dave Jones as a bobblehead. And literally, this is like blocks away from where Dave Jones lived. That is a brutal campaign tactic. This is going to be a hot race.
Logistically, probably well-planned, I would say, if that's by where he lives. All right, let's head to City Council District 5. This is North Oak Park, Hollywood Park, South Sac. There's also a good amount of development that's taking place in this district, Chris. What stands out to you about the candidates who are running to represent District 5?
Yeah, this is like the longest city council district after redistricting. It goes from, like you mentioned, North Oak Park all the way down to actually part of Valley High. So it spans a very long distance. You have quite a few people running for it. The two top are Katie Maple, who is a longtime homelessness advocate, used to work for a cannabis industry. Then you have Tamiko Heim, who is a state worker who is endorsed by the previous candidate, longtime city council member, Jay Chenier. The biggest thing that obviously you're going to have here is what's going on with Aggie Square. Aggie Square is coming to District 5, and it's going to fuel certain issues like gentrification and housing costs, and really how are things going to be dealt with going forward with this big, massive billion-dollar sort of UC Davis tech hub, where the job's going to go to housing. What new housing is going to be built? Are new houses and along the Stockton corridor going to be going up anytime soon? What about the Franklin Boulevard corridor? So you have this big, massive project that's going to really spur growth throughout most of District 5. And how that's going to be dealt with is going to be very interesting and to see going forward, and how these candidates deal with that will be interesting to see as well.
Right. Housing and economic development. But for whom? And there's been a lot of conversations
right.
about displacement. Let's head now to Sacramento County District Attorney. We now know the current district attorney, Anne Marie Schubert, is running for AG. Has Schubert endorsed anybody?
She has. She's supporting Ten Ho. And Ten is the assistant chief deputy DA currently. He has the backing of a business and several Democrats as well. So this is an interesting race, too, because it's, I mean, the first time in my lifetime that we're not having Jan Scully or Anne Marie Schubert as a DA. We're also, this will be the first time we have a district attorney of color representing Sacramento County. Ten Ho is going up against Alana Matthews. Alana Matthews has, you know, local roots, went to McGeorge, worked as deputy DA, then went to work for the California Energy Commission in the state, focusing on climate change and energy issues. She has big Democratic endorsement backings and the big backing of labor. And it seems like the local Democrats are really coalescing behind her in a way they haven't really done in the past for a candidate that either challenged Schubert or Scully. So this is going to be a race that is decided on June 7th. This will not go to November because you have to get a majority to win this. And if so, somebody's going to win one of the two candidates on June 7th. And this is one we're watching very closely. Our reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, our race and equity journalist on staff, is focusing on this race.
Yeah, we have two big races, particularly in Sacramento County. That moves us over to the sheriff. Current Sheriff Jones is now throwing his hat in again for a congressional seat. Who is running for the Sacramento County Sheriff's race, Chris?
Two guys named Jim. You got a Jim Barnes and a Jim Cooper. I think Jim Cooper's name probably rings out in many people's minds at the moment as a current assembly member. He used to be a former deputy sheriff for Sacramento Sheriff's office. And you have Jim Barnes, who's currently the chief deputy to Sheriff Scott Jones, obviously sort of Scott Jones' handpicked replacement as well. It's going to be one of those races where there's going to be a lot of money spent as well. Cooper so far is outspending Barnes more than $600,000 to Barnes's $225,000. It's going to be one of those ones where it's you have the potential of both the big money dollars, but also some policies that are going to either change or not change at all. So you have under Jim Barnes, who again is the current chief deputy to Scott Jones,
and has Sheriff minor differences. And Sheriff Jones endorses under Sheriff Barnes, yes.
So you have obviously this candidate who's been a long time worker under Scott Jones, who doesn't necessarily have all of the same ideals, but certainly still along those lines. And then you have incoming current assemblyman Jim Cooper, who used to be, again, a deputy sheriff in the sheriff's department, who will be coming in and trying to change some things. So there's certainly going to be a heated battle, one of conversations of, you know, criminal justice reforms, things that will be happening in the jail. Obviously, there are some concerns with transparency in the Sacramento County Jail. So, you know, you'll see what happens from there as well. So it's going to be a race to focus on for sure.
And like the DA race, Vicky, this could be the end of an era for Sacramento where you had Anne-Marie Schubert and Jan Scully running the district attorney's office for so many years. In Sacramento, you had John McGinnis, our former sheriff. He's actually a radio host on KFBK now. And you had Scott Jones, his chosen successor. So now are we going to go with Jim Barnes, Scott Jones' chosen successor? Are we going to go this new way with Jim Cooper, who has law enforcement roots, used to work for Sacramento County Sheriff's Office, has raised a ton of money, taken some of the money he raised in the assembly? It's such a interesting transformational moment for Sacramento right now, and I'm really curious to see when voters weigh in.
Yeah, it's like the end of a chapter or an era. Chris and Nick, thank you all so much for just really unpacking all of the work y'all are doing at Cap Radio.
No, anytime. Here we go.
Yeah, of course. Thanks.
And that is Nick Miller and Chris Hooks with Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. They're the largest single ethnic group in the state and account for half of the country's population growth in the previous decade, according to the 2020 census. But Latinos are far from a monolith. Our stories encompass generations of migration and colonization, spanning 20 countries and more than a dozen territories. And all of these cultural and lived experiences are far and wide. That includes politics. According to the Public Policy Institute of California, more than half of likely Latino voters are registered as Democrats. That's about 58% as of 2020. But ideologically, in that same PPIC report, they found that Latinos are divided when they identify themselves as liberal, middle of the road, and conservative. I spoke with two political strategists who have studied Latino voting trends for decades. Mike Madrid is a communications expert with Grassroots Lab and co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Luis Alvarado is a longtime California political strategist. I am so happy that we're having this conversation. It takes me back to LA. Like, I'm Mexican, my father's Mexican, but I have so many friends who are also mixed race, and a lot of them are Latino. They're from Nicaragua, they're from South America, Cuba, Puerto Rico. And if you put us all in a room to talk about politics, we would have very different views. And so when we talk about the Latino vote, I think that in and of itself is inherently wrong. And then I just want to ask the both of you, I guess, what is your view on this idea of the Latino vote? Mike?
Well, you've asked quite a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. And I think that with the way you've characterized it is probably actually true. There is a lot of diversity, obviously, in the Latino community, and it's important to remember that our Hispanicity, which is a little bit different than Latino identity, is actually an ethnicity. It's not a race. And so there's an extraordinarily large amount of country of origin differences which account for these different opinions that we have so often talked about historically in the Hispanic Latino community. I would suggest, though, that up until very recently, at least at the national level, and certainly in states like California, the Latino vote has absolutely been monolithic. It meets every definition of a voting block. So regardless of the ethnic identity or country of origin or even language dominance that you use, Latinos have up until very recently been voting like a block. And then we are just now beginning to witness that diversity and that change. There has been a rightward shift towards the Republican Party, quite discernible since the 2020 elections and the off-cycle elections. And I think that's accounting for both parties getting a little bit more interested, excited, and finally, after many decades of people like Luis and myself pushing for this, expending the resources required to make the vote competitive. And we're going to see, I think, this year, a very different approach from both parties, very different messaging from both parties, and very different tactics from both parties.
Yeah, Luis, you focus on Latino engagement, and you know, I think what we're talking about, we all have different stories of becoming Americans and coming here. What are you hearing, or what are you kind of seeing in your surveys and focus groups and polling when it comes to more broadly the Latino vote in California?
We're in California, where we have a great amount of Latino communities that continue to grow and continue to diversify and continue to be molded, and even also communities that, especially with the young voters, that are starting to separate themselves from being packaged as a Latino voter. We see that campaigns are having to try to restructure their approaches towards the Latinos as a bloc, and are starting to accept that you cannot just have one strategy of messaging for that one community. You actually have to invest the time to understand the communities you're trying to affect, the candidates that you're trying to elevate, or the candidates or propositions you're trying to take down. So it's basically, like Mike said, is, you know, we've been watching how other general election campaigns have been doing this for years, you know, talking about the blue collar worker versus the college educated, and you have to have a whole different campaign for that. Well, the same applies to the Latino communities. You know, if you're a Salvadoreño, who's first generation, blue collar worker, you're going to see the political world much different. If you're a third generation, you know, higher income college graduate. So the taxation issues, the inflation issues are going to be completely different. And it, one of the things that we're starting to see here in California is that immigration, which was one of the biggest proponents or the biggest catalyst for how messaging was being created, is no longer the number one reason or methodology used for creating those strategies. You know, the inflation and the gas prices and workforce and those are the things in the economy. And most importantly, what I also see is with public safety being the number two issues that are affecting the Latino community on the ground. And that is what campaigns have to be ready to address in both languages.
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, there's a lot of nuances to this. And it's not just, you know, like the big R, the big D at opposite ends of the spectrum, but there's a lot of gradients of gray to this. And that given that Latinos accounted for more than half of the country's population growth in the previous decade, they are the state's single largest ethnic group since 2014. Do you think campaigns in election or in election years do enough or outreach to such a huge significant voting group, a voting bloc in California, Luis?
No. The answer is still no. But we've seen changes in understanding and acceptance, but we still don't see, as strategists, we don't see the commitments to the budget on those big, large campaigns, especially for the proposition ones. It's just unnerving to me that even though the data is clear, sometimes there is just no appetite. And I don't know if it's because they're scared and they're afraid to actually dabble and make a mistake when addressing the Latino community, or if they just feel that it's not economically feasible for those people running those campaigns to address those issues in those communities. But in certain cities, like in Los Angeles, we have countywide races that are being contentious, and you have the Latino community, which is about 0.5% of the voting population in LA County, that you don't have a choice and you actually have to invest. And if you don't invest and you don't apply those resources to connecting with a Latino community, then you're not going to be able to help your cause.
Yeah. Mike, back in 1997 at Georgetown University, you wrote a senior thesis on Latino politics and emerging Latino voter groups. I mean, that was over 20 years ago. How has this evolved in America?
You know, that's a fantastic and timely question, mainly because I'm sitting actually at Georgetown right now, and I'm also going to be turning that work into a book. What has been nice about this experience is 20 years ago, as a younger person watching the numbers and seeing the demography of the country unfold and what was likely to happen over my lifetime and my career allowed me to kind of prognosticate about what was likely to come and what would happen. I decided to spend the first part of my career in California, where it was going to be front row and center, and experience a lot of those changes and actually run campaigns and see how both parties were addressing this demographic change. Now, going forward, the second half of my career will be taking that experience and working across the country as other states experience what California went through, and we can see some of the similarities and some of the changes. So I think the most exciting part about what we are all experiencing as Americans, as we are watching the Latinization of American politics, is for the first time in this country's history, we will be a non-white, non-European ancestry majority country. Similar to what most listeners, I think, have experienced during their time in California. And it changes our governance. It changes our politics. And Latinos will change the country as much as this country will change the Latino experience. So it's a really, truly unique American story that we are, I think, privileged to watch unfold.
Yeah, and given that, Mike, I mean, what is being done or not being done well in terms of outreach to the Latino voter groups?
Well, Latinos, we have to remember, are disproportionately a younger segment of the population. We are also lower on the economic rung, both because we're more recently migrated, but also because we're younger, and there's a correlation between being young and having less money. And those two factors, perhaps more than anything else, speaks to lower civic participation. And so there's a good body of thought, one that I tend to agree with, which is as Latinos become older, the average age of the Hispanic in the country is 27 years old compared to 36 for the average non-Hispanic white. We're at different life age, different times in our life cycle, different priorities. Latinos are just starting families, have younger children in public schools. those issues will become more paramount and more important over the next 10, 15 years. And Latinos will become, they'll have a greater stake in society, meaning will have a stronger tendency to do things like vote, to run for office, to be more civically engaged as they develop a stronger stake in society. And so that's, I think, one of the more promising developments is a lot of this is a function of age, but there's no question we must always, I think, be vigilant in trying to do the outreach, to do the communication, and to do the education on the absolute critical importance of having a community engaged and making sure that its voice is represented at every level of government.
You know, I asked this to Luis. Do you think political parties do an effective job in reaching out to this voting group or even understanding these voters?
No, neither party has a firm grasp at all. And I've got a unique position in that I've worked at the highest levels of campaigns in California, certainly in both parties. And it's very clear that neither party has really even a cursory understanding of what is motivating Latino voters. So no, both parties, for their own ideological reasons, are kind of locked in communicating to older white voters because they tend to disproportionately represent the electorate. Those are the people who actually do show up and vote. And so the focus remains there. The structures of power in the party systems remain there. And there's very little done and not nearly enough resources or talent committed to focusing on addressing this problem for both parties. And what that has meant in California is extremely low turnout numbers that are very problematic for the health of a democracy. And it is remarkable to see a state that's overwhelmingly blue, the Democratic, the way California is, there's such a keen lack of understanding on how to engage what should be a base constituency for their party. And then seeing other states like Florida, where there are a lot of Republican Cuban Americans in Miami and South Dade with the exact same problem on the Republican side. So it's a problem that afflicts both parties, regardless of how deep red or deep blue each state is.
And Miami went to Trump, correct, in 2020?
Yeah, considerably. It did. Miami and Miami-Dade County, South Florida, did go towards Trump. It was the first time there was a multi-generational coalition of Cuban Americans, meaning those who came from Cuba and their grandchildren, and certainly their children, were for the first time voting Republican in considerable, significant numbers. That was a trend that we saw starts to wane up until the Trump era that seems to have consolidated. But perhaps more importantly, we were starting to see Mexican-Americans, especially in Texas and Nevada, Colorado, Virginia, starts to shift towards the right, which is a much more, I think, interesting and broader focus towards the center by Hispanic voters.
Well, Luis, given that California, we're relatively a young population, we're the eighth youngest population in the United States, and then wrapped within that are Latinos, which are younger as well, as we just heard from Mike. How is that playing out in terms of statewide elections here, even voter registrations or lack thereof in California?
Well, it goes back to the word young. And my personal experience is I have a nephew who's 33 years old, does very well, college educated, and has a very comfortable job and is looking for a home, and he says he can't buy a house. So that young population that doesn't have a highway to get into what historically have been how Americans live the American dream, they don't have access to it. You know, they're being challenged on a daily basis, and COVID certainly has played a big job in how that exacerbates the illnesses that the society has and what we see on TV at 6 p.m. So those challenges goes back to the economy, and it goes back to feeling safe in your community. And Latinos are the ones that probably are going to feel it the most. And those sentiments are driving the polling with regards to issues that are important in their day-to-day life. And what the difference is between how do you target or how do you outreach to Latinos is how do you engage them where they actually are going to be reading the newspapers or what TV stations they're watching or what kind of communities they're engaging in. And if you are able to do that with a Latino sensibility, then you're going to have the ability to talk to them a little bit more clear and get a little bit of opportunity to expose what your vision is for the Latino community. And I don't see that being put in place as well as it could have been. And we still see very much that strategies to connect with Latinos are still decades back in the past of, you know, where Prop 187 was the catalyst of what how people thought you needed to talk to Latinos. And if you can talk to Latinos about the economy or the future or how you can make their lives better for them and their future generations, you're going to have a very difficult time in connecting with them.
Given that they're the state's single largest ethnic group, and we also have a growing no party preference registration, it rivals Republicans in California. Do you think that all of this is playing a role in that, like not being disillusioned with either party?
Oh, absolutely. I, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing is not just the conservative versus the progressive ideology being at play here, but I see more of a authoritarian line of campaigning that is taking a hold that is very attractive to many Latinos and pushing them away from the progressive streak that the Democrats are being painted as one of the reasons why you have more people dissatisfied with both parties and ending up in the middle as no party preference. You know, like we said at the beginning, they're just not connecting ideologically with any of the parties. And from an operational perspective, neither party has been on key in how to engage those communities to be able to separate that their ideology is the solution for those ailments which they are facing on a day-to-day life.
Mike, what do you think about that? And if you do agree, is that a bad thing, being no party preference?
No, actually, I think it's a great thing. And actually, what we have seen is a lot of data over the course of the past decade that shows that even though Latinos oftentimes register as Democrats, within about 4 or 5 years, they disaffiliate and they move to a no party preference. When you take that data point, and then you also look at the burgeoning numbers of and growth of no party preference data, combine that with about a 3-decade cycle of extraordinarily low turnout, the evidence is pretty clear that Latinos don't feel particularly represented or much of a connection with either party. They're neither being pulled positively by Democrats or Republicans. They're being negatively pushed. The only times that we see spikes in turnout and spikes in Latino participation is when there's a particular issue or particular candidate that is perceived to be an attack on the community. And you start to see a mobilization that is what we call a negative push to the polls. That's, again, a very unhealthy sign of a democracy. Generally, it's a very unhealthy politicization of a community specifically. And that's really been the California story. And I think it's why we have this extremely large differential between non-white Hispanics and Hispanics in civic engagement, in political participation, and really in segregation, not just amongst zip codes, but in our civic participation. It really doesn't bode well, I think, for the future health of a state as big and diverse as California, having the fastest growing segment of the population not taking a particular interest in the governance of the state.
Yeah, I mean, we all pay the consequences with disengagement and apathy. In the last minute or so that we have, I'd like to get some final thoughts from the both of you. I mean, it's a midterm election year. Where do you see this heading, Mike?
Well, I think for the 2022 midterms, I think you're going to see a slight increase with Hispanic turnout. It will come nowhere near where white turnout is, and it will probably not meet the number of African-American or percentage of African-American turnout as a share of the electorate, or even maybe even Asian Pacific Islanders, meaning the largest ethnic plurality in the state of California will have the lowest turnout numbers. Again, that's just a very dispiriting sign. It's very troubling, and it speaks to not just the problems that we have as a one-party state in California, but really other socioeconomic factors that are really eroding at the base of civic participation. I think real quickly, that what's going to happen is Democrats will continue in the state to dominate the vote. I think it'll be a 75% vote for Democrats. It could be critical in seats that are contested to an Orange County held by Republicans, which could go to the Democrats with a high turnout. And then one Central Valley seat, Congressman Valadao's seat, which is very over 40% Hispanic, Latino voters will be determinative in the outcome of that race.
Yeah. Luis?
Well, I agree with everything Mike said, obviously. The one thing where I see the difference is, you know, when it comes to like congressional seats. And when it comes to constitutional seats, I think everything's pretty much status quo. One of the things that I've seen is that now you have more Dem on Dem challenges, which is more of the progressive Democrat versus the, you know, the centrist Democrat. And those are the fights that I'm seeing in California. My focus is more in the municipalities and how municipal leadership is being portrayed. And, you know, we see in Los Angeles, we see an authoritarian sheriff being challenged by the community as a whole. I see the mayoral race. You see a business mogul, you know, running against established Democrat politicos. And the question that I'm trying to figure out here is where the Latino community feels that their leadership has to come. And I think that's being developed in an interesting base right now. And that's where I think the future of the Latino vote is going to be, and how we demonstrate we're going to be able to take care of their interests at home in their zip code, like Mike said.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
And that is my conversation with Mike Madrid, a communications expert with Grassroots Lab and co-founder of the Lincoln Project, as well as political strategist Luis Alvarado, discussing Latino voting trends. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, let's face it, it's been a rough couple of years for most of us, and it can just get easy to get caught up in all of that, which is out of our control. But musician Xochi Umrocio took life's challenges and transformed them into fuel for her fiery debut album, Bitter. Here to tell us more about her album is musician Xochi Umrocio. Xochi, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so you are Xochi Umrocio of Coyote Creates. Where did Coyote Creates come from?
Well, to tell you the truth, my first name is spelled X-O-C-H-I-T-L, which is a great and beautiful name, which I like now, but it can be a little bit of a marketing nightmare. So I had to figure out something different so people could find me a lot easier. And Coyote was a word that crossed over to everything I am, you know, which is American, Mexican, and Native American. And that word coyote or avocado was my other choice, crossed over to all of those things. So that's why I chose that name.
You are a Sacramento native. You're currently in Truckee, but your musical journey began in the womb. Your parents were musicians, and it kind of led into this formative, fateful decision when you were in a college math class. Can you take us back to that moment?
That's so funny. I just mentioned this on Good Day Sacramento. I was sitting in my math class in college, and I was in college for the wrong reasons. I didn't really want to be there. School was never really quite my thing. And I remember sitting in this math class for my business major, and I'm sitting in math class, and my voice intuition just said, if you don't leave now, you never will. You need to leave. So I literally packed up my backpack and I walked out of that math class. And after that, I switched some of my classes over to more musical classes. But that is a true story. Hmm.
Your album is titled Bitter, and it's your debut album. How do you describe it or explain it to someone who's about to listen to it?
Well, there's a lot of different genres on there, which at first I thought, you know, might be kind of hard to market, or some people might not connect because it's too, it kind of goes all over the map a little bit. But I think it actually ended up working out quite well, and you can see different sides of me throughout the entire album. So hang tight and enjoy the ride, is what I would say.
Yeah, well, let's get right to it. One of your favorite songs on the album is Spell of the Moon. So let's take a quick listen. It's romantic, but I also can feel the bittersweetness of it as well. What inspired Spell of the Moon?
Spell of the Moon was written when it's heartbreak, but I love that song so much, not because it's so sad, but because thinking of when I wrote that song, I used to have a truck and I would lay in the bed every full moon. I would drive out to the middle of nowhere, the Elk Grove County country roads. And I would just lay under the moon with hot tea and donuts. And that time I had brought my guitar, and that's the song that came out of there. I remember just the moon being so big and so beautiful and so bright, but it was hazy and I almost couldn't see it. And that's what I remember writing that song.
All right, let's get to the next song. It's called Kitchen Conversations. Yeah, that's definitely something we can all rock out to. How were creating these songs and recording this album over, you know, a period that was very much separation, you know, because of the pandemic?
These songs were recorded over a period of time, the last 3 years, but recording during COVID was my therapy. It was me in a room with one other person spilling my journal out, my deepest, darkest thoughts out. So for me, that was really healthy. And that is how I dealt with COVID. And I feel really lucky to have that outlet.
Yeah, it's certainly cathartic and therapeutic. The last song we have is called Devil. So and this is about being excited to meet a new friend. So tell us more about who or what was the inspiration for this song.
I wrote this song, again, that's a great way to put it, meeting a new friend. And I felt really sassy when I wrote this. So when I wrote it, I really imagined myself in this dark, smoky, like old jazz club with a fancy dress and an old cigarette and a fuzzy coat, singing this with a cigarette in my hand on stage. And that's how the song came to life.
Hours when I leave, you put up a fight.
Oh, yeah, I get the sultriness of that one. That...
yes. You know, I want to give a quick shout out really quickly.
Yes, please do.
Richie Smith on bass, and he also recorded it. I had Jared Alfonso on drums and Stephen Hendry on lead guitar. I had to give those musicians a shout out. They, again, brought the song to life and would not exist without them.
You know, finally, we only have about 30 seconds left, but your music has such a range, and especially given that this is your debut album, but you're also passionate about supporting creative youth, and you were a vocal and guitar coach for Girls Rock Sacramento. So in the last few seconds we have, I guess, what's your advice for young female artists trying to make their mark in this industry?
Keep going. And obviously everyone says that, but another thought I have is, I imagine if my favorite artists hadn't taken the guts to say what they wanted to say or done what they have wanted to done, and I'd be a completely different person now. And I'm so thankful to my favorite artists who took that risk. So that's what I say to young women and any artist, is just take the chance.
Xochi Hermosillo, thank you so much for sharing your debut album with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we have a link to that album, Bitter, on our Insight page at capradio.org. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.